When the survey of the Alaska Range finally got off the ground with the Boston Museum of Science and Dr. Bradford Washburn in charge, there was also interest, in addition to the Alaska Range, the Wrangell Mountain area and the Bering Glacier. The Bering Glacier is the largest glacier in Alaska. Dr. Meader Miller was very active on oil surface geology survey of the area. And at this time, he flew with Cordova Airlines from the fishing village on the coast of Cordova. Very scenic setting for a coastal town and a very strategic location for the Prince William Sound and Gulf of Alaska fishing fleets to operate from. However, as a base, with Cordova Airlines used Cordova to fly from to the Bering Glacier to pursue the oil geology of the surface contacts, which would determine the feasibility of oil in the area. My question, of course, was, in the event the formation suitable or they find oil seeps on the various synclines and anticlines and the geology on this and scattered throughout this huge glacier, that is to say the outcrops appeared in the form of rock outcrops that the glacier flowed around. This was the objective of the oil geology survey team, to take rock samples and determine if the type of rock was sedimentary or suitable. And geologists have a great knowledge of the times rocks were formed, and in this way they could determine whether or not underneath the Bering Glacier was a suitable supply of oil, or if the area contained enough oil to rate further exploration. Down on the beach of Catella, which is several hundred miles to the east of the Bering Glacier, great oil seeps come from the area through the shale rock and drain into the Prince William Sound. The pilot for Dr. Maynard Miller, a very competent airman, Herb Haley was his name, was extremely active in the area, one of Cordova Airlines' best pilots. Unfortunately, he was involved in a fatal crash. Aboard, he had a load of dynamite. The dynamite did not detonate. It was the crash due to turbulence on an approach to an area about 300 miles northwest of Anchorage that the crash took place. However, there remained the need to service Dr. Maynard Millard's oil surface geology camps, and I spent the next 2 summers airlifting the various geology survey teams to all quadrants of the Bering Glacier and thereabouts. Also, at this particular time, there was a great interest in the ordnance, U.S. Army, in regard to cold weather test gear. Now, in the early 50s, a suitable foot gear had not been yet developed to compete with 50 below zero weather for the average itinerant in this type of sub-zero temperature. So the Army Ordnance, Fort Ord, Virginia, I believe, sent Major Hackett. Now, Major Hackett was an experienced mountaineer. I'd had his teams on McKinley, three different expeditions on cold weather test. In order that the Army should have the finest of cold weather gear, it was required that a considerable cold weather test program be initiated. So this was in action, and Mount Logan was the objective. Mount Logan is nearly as tall as McKinley, at about 19,000, and it stands slightly inside the Canadian border. Very spectacular range, the Wrangell Mountains, of which Mount Logan is a part. In the range also is St. Elias and many lesser peaks. Very spectacular scenery, tremendous ice falls, very rugged glaciers, very rugged scenery. The whole world is tipped on end. Below the jagged peaks are miles and miles of nearly trackless glaciers. I say nearly trackless. On at least a half dozen occasions, up to the 10,000 foot levels, I have located tracks and have followed the tracks and located various types of animals. Crossing the great ice fields of the Bering Glacier or of the, in the Wrangells that is, or of the other glaciers of the Alaska Range, which is an extension actually of the Wrangells to the northwest. On one occasion, I was curious as to two sets of wolf tracks. I followed the wolf tracks. I was making a landing for a scientific expedition to Hiltna Pass between Mount McKinley and Mount Foraker. At the 10,400 foot level, I should behold two large timber wolves topping out the ridge between Kahiltna Glacier and the north approach, which would be Peters Glacier. Occasionally, I've located a set of tracks and have seen both grizzly brown and also black bear crossing the high ranges from one quadrant to the next. A great amount of bird life, surprisingly enough, is found at high altitudes. The ravens are a constant threat to mountaineers' food supplies as they fly to extreme altitudes. I've seen ravens circle at 17,000 feet, flying effortlessly in the thermals of McKinley. And they're a very persistent bird. They have an extremely strong beak, and anything short of a metal canister will not protect the mountaineer's food. So the standard procedure is to get the square 5-gallon cans with the large open top and to store the supplies on the relay as the mountaineers progress up the mountains in these tin canisters with a sealed wired on top. And many a canister I've seen that's shown the battle damage of the ravens' very powerful, strong beaks. Any lesser covering, such as cardboard or canvas or paper covering, is no problem for the ravens. They go through two or three layers of cardboard like cream cheese. At any rate, we'll continue with Dr. Maynard Miller's oil surface geology survey. It was an integral part of the U.S. Geological Survey of the mapping of the strategic minerals of Alaska. In spite of the fact we made probably in excess of 100 landings in different locations, the elevations never exceeded 8,500 feet. The weather was chosen, and no problem, we moved those crews in and out with a minimum of delay, and Dr. Maynard Miller went happily on his way. Not so with Major Hackett's cold weather test of Mount Logan. They experienced, in spite of the fact they were mountaineers of long standing, difficulty in the logistics. The landing area was at about 10,300 foot west approach. On these glaciers, you must understand, you must have some requirements. At the elevation of 10,000 feet or higher, there must be a suitable grade to effect a successful takeoff, especially loaded configuration. High landings are 14,300 feet for standard non-supercharged light aircraft that we fly. At the present time, I have a supercharged six-passenger Cessna that develops sea level horsepower at 14,000 feet, but the aircraft weighs a ton empty, and it would take about 10 good men to move the plane if you got it stuck. So for the high altitudes, in most locations, the best aircraft to use is the 150 horsepower Super Cub, a finely tuned Super Cub with retractable skis. Is the best weapon for the 14,000 foot elevations, especially in view of the fact that usually your takeoff areas are restricted. Now the landing speed of this small aircraft loaded is about 40 miles an hour as against 65 or 70 miles an hour with the larger aircraft. Of course, only one passenger is carried, and if the area is suitable, you can pioneer out a location with a small aircraft, and then, if suitable, you usually use the larger aircraft. And then I have hauled a gross load at 12,500 feet in a stock model 230 horsepower 180 Cessna, finely tuned. At any rate, Major Hackett's base camp, but approximately the 10,500 foot level west approach, left a lot to be desired. We could have landed higher. Our base of operations was the old mining town of May Creek in the area of the Middle Wrangell Mountains. This was our jumping off spot. The crew consisted of 13 cold weather test members, and the crew remained in the area for a month. Usually in the high mountains, you usually choose the weather to begin the expedition airlift, but because of the change and the constant shifting of air masses and the influence of the Japanese Gulf Stream current, the Prince William Sound Gulf of Alaska, acts as a great mixing bowl. Occasionally, the weather will hold for several days, but usually, if a large expedition is to be hauled, the first part will be under ideal conditions, and the last part will be under somewhat less than ideal conditions. That is, a high overcast might roll in, the wind might start up, or it could turn into a cumulonimbus type operation with rain showers turning to snow at the high altitudes and obscuring the peaks. This is a normal operation for the high altitude mountains of Alaska. The weather is never statically good or never statically bad. It's on a constant change. Temperature of the sun affects the high and the low pressure masses. The density altitude makes a difference. This is the particular temperature to give an altitude in regard to its effect on the way your aircraft flies. For instance, at 14,000 feet, in the cool of the morning, say from 3 o'clock until 7 or 8, you get a lower true altitude than an altimeter properly set at the barometric pressure would indicate. This is because the air is thicker. The air gives the airfoil of the aircraft a better opportunity to create lift. Later on in the afternoon, as the thermals and the turbulence begin to cover the area, this is a less suitable time because the density altitude goes the other way. The temperature rises, the air becomes less thick, the air becomes turbulent, squirrely winds invade the mountainous areas from all directions, and naturally the lift coefficient is considerably less. Properly set, an altimeter at a given station pressure at 14,000 feet in the middle of a hot afternoon might give you a density altitude of 16,000 feet. Now this is important because a non-supercharged engine, you lose approximately 8.5 to 10 horsepower per 1,000 feet. In the 180 Cessna, if you were to start with 230 horsepower, you can easily see that you would be short of about 130 horsepower at the 14,000 foot level. This wouldn't be conducive to a takeoff unless the aircraft are supercharged, whereas the compressors would, in the supercharging arrangement, would give you sea level power, 30 inches of manifold pressure. A great factor in choosing a landing on the glaciers is the presence of enough light to evaluate the angles of the glacier, possible crevasses, pressure ridges, and wind conditions. Wind conditions can be noticed from the from the action, if any, of snow on the high ridges and high points, also from the drift of the aircraft, also from the shadow of the aircraft as it flies over an area. The perfect ideal condition, of course, would be dead calm wind, beautiful bright sunlight, and no clouds. Seldom do you get all these beautiful wishes. You're forced to settle for much less, such as partial cloud cover. The worst of all is down in a crosswind for takeoff. Suppose that you have this Cessna loaded with four passengers and 400 pounds of gear, plus yourself, of course, and you land in a quartering nose wind up a steep glacier. Your problems have just begun. You must effect a takeoff down in a crosswind in order that you evacuate the glacier. Now, with an empty aircraft, this is considerably more simple than with a loaded aircraft. Down and a crosswind takeoffs should not be attempted unless the pilot is very familiar with the aircraft and thoroughly evaluates the wind. The wind coefficient in an aircraft that stalls at 60 miles an hour in a wind crossed quartering tailwind of say 30 miles an hour would put your speed, your moving speed, at in excess of 100 miles an hour before a takeoff was possible. First you must overcome the coefficient of crosswind. It's a 30 mile an hour tail crosswind, which will be in excess of 30 miles an hour on its effect of the airfoil. Then you must accelerate fast enough to overcome the stalling speed of the aircraft, which is, say, 60 miles an hour empty. So it's easy to see the problem. You must accelerate in excess of 100 miles an hour down the glacier before you are able to fly. And this would create, of course, problems. If you had a confined takeoff area, you could very well wind up in a deep crevasse or in an unsuitable area for the takeoff. In the event of an aborted takeoff, you would probably demolish the airplane if you cut the power and slid into the rough ice hummocks, of which there are many thousands of acres. Few of the areas are suitable for landings. A few more of the areas are suitable in a lighter aircraft, but 90% of the glaciated areas of Alaska are not suitable for landing. Possibly 95% are not suitable for landing. There's great consideration when you land of the impending takeoff. Many of the aircraft disaster has taken place after a successful landing, but during a loaded takeoff, especially at altitude. You recall you lose 8 to 10 horsepower per 1,000 feet. At 10,000 feet, you're short 100 horsepower. So this is a tremendous factor in evaluating a landing area in the high-altitude glacier areas of Alaska or the high-altitude landing areas of any other location. The Sierra Nevadas have some 10,000-foot wheel fields that have accounted for quite a few aircraft. Likewise, in South America, at high altitudes, the takeoff run, unless the aircraft is supercharged back to sea level, is sometimes three or four times the sea level takeoff run, especially above the 10,000 foot level. And during the early 50s, a large team of about 14 climbers from California indicated their desire to climb a series of peaks in the Mount Logan area. I suggested that the team go to the old village of Chitna, which is located on the Copper River in the beautiful Wrangell Mountains, the west approach to the Wrangell Mountains. And in due time, the team arrived. And they had a considerable amount of gear, and their objective was to climb a whole series of peaks in the Mount Logan Lucania Anderson Glacier area at the source of the Chitna Glacier. The relay continued to the old mining strip of May Creek, located near McCarthy, the location of the once rich copper deposit. This copper deposit was so substantial they took out millions of dollars worth of ore at nearby the village of McCarthy at the rate of 5 cents a pound for the ore. The mine was discontinued in 1938. I believe it was started in the early 1920s. A railroad was even built in to haul the ore to Cordova. There's a tremendous story of the railroad and the mining activities and the problems of building the railroad over the glaciers and across the mighty Copper River. A distance of probably 200 miles from Cordova into McCarthy. And each spring the railroad bridge had to be rebuilt because the mighty Copper River would completely, with the huge tremendous ice jams, wash out the 1,500, 2,000 foot spans built the previous season. At any rate, the whole team was relayed to a mining strip of May Creek. Now, this is almost in the heart of the Wrangell Mountains. A new national park has been set aside for this area. It's tremendously scenic. The mountains are unbelievably rugged. It's a great game country. Many mountain sheep and mountain goats and caribou, the grizzly bear, the brown bear, the black bears, all the fur animals, the wolverines and the foxes and the wolves. Even as of late, they have a considerable herd of buffalo, which has filtered into the area from the Big Delta area. Great herds of caribou roam the Wrangell Mountains. It's an inaccessible place. An ideal location for a national park. There are many lakes, many streams in the area. It's the location of the headwaters for many millions of tons of salmon that swim the Copper River and spawn at the headwaters of the Chitna and the various other sources of the Copper River. May Creek was primarily a gold mining location. This is a highly mineralized area. In addition to the base metals of copper and lead, zinc and other ores, a considerable value of raw gold has been mined in the McCarthy May Creek locations. Presently, evaluation teams from all the major geology companies in the whole world are checking out the Wrangell Mountains for mineralization. The first takeoff, of course, is the important one. More important yet is the first landing. Our objective was about the 12,000 to the 10,000 foot area of the Anderson Glacier, located about 15 air miles due north of Mount Logan. The weather was ideal. We proceeded. The aircraft I used was a one-passenger Super Cub. This required at least 15 trips into the area. The distance was approximately 180 miles round trip. The Super Cub is not known for its speed. It is primarily a short field airplane, cruises 100 miles an hour loaded, and I was able to begin the airlift from May Creek to the area of the Anderson Glacier. I mentioned our objective was a suitable landing location between the 10 and the 12,000 foot area, upper source Anderson Glacier. This would put the UCLA team in striking distance of 14 peaks heretofore unclimbed by anyone and looked upon only from a great distance by itinerant people flying by an aircraft. The airlift went smoothly and I had the 13 passengers and the freight divided into a total of 15 trips. Nightfall finally arrived. The sky was quite clear. I continued the airlift throughout the night. The following day, likewise, the airlift continued. At 2.5 hours a trip, we involved something like 2 flying days to load, unload, do the flying, and expedite the airlift operation to this location on the Anderson Glacier. This is a normal procedure to begin an airlift and to continue until you're finished. And usually I can go several days and nights and continue the airlift so that a change of weather will not discontinue the airlift, which would of course necessitate returning to the area at a later time and slow down the whole operation. Nightfall of the second day arrived, accompanied by a heavy overcast and rain squalls. Needless to say, I needed some sleep, but I had it figured 4 more loads would wrap up the complete expedition, and then I could return to Talkeetna and get on with other business of this area in the Alaska Range. Needless to say, the whole thing was an endurance contest. That is, I'd started flying early one morning, continued all day through that night, continued all the following day, and now I have but four loads left. Ominous overcast is moving in from the southeast. It looks like a tremendous storm. Light rain squalls in the high quadrants, light snow showers at higher elevations, and I'm quite desperate to move the last four loads. It is now about 10 o'clock at night. I'm beginning the fourth load. As they say, each load takes approximately 2.5 hours. That would be another 10 hours of flying. This would run me through the second night, weather permitting. But I felt able to continue the next night shift, so the fourth load was duly loaded. Upon arrival at the landing area at about the 10,700 foot level, Anderson Glacier, I made a discovery. Since I was flying into the area of overcast, it was considerably darker in the mountains. I had problems threading my way through the various passes and over the peaks to find the proper location. I'd instructed the ground crew that if it went overcast and got dark, they were to soak newspaper in kerosene and form a border for my landing area. So 10 miles distant, the first flare was lit. It promptly went out. Everything was black, pitch black. I'm in a one-way canyon landing at 10,700 feet in the dark. I hold my heading and hope that they get the border of the runway outlined with burning kerosene-soaked newspapers. 5 miles later, and inbound to a pitch-black landing area, several more of the papers lighted the way to my landing area. It was quite spooky because the paper would not burn but a few minutes, kerosene-soaked newspaper, and as I approached the landing area, I had great apprehensions of all the fires going out at the wrong time. I had my position lights on. I was blinking frantically with my landing lights, hoping that they would further light my landing area. And finally, on the final approach, into a pitch black one dead stop valley, I lucked out and was fortunate that they lighted four of kerosene-soaked newspapers at the same time and made a suitable location with enough depth perception for me to effect the landing. Needless to say, we straightened out our signals, and on the subsequent three landings, which continued throughout the night, in the light of light snow and rain, I was able to complete the landing of the whole expedition and their freight loads, and I continued wearily on my way back to refuel at the old mining strip of McCarthy. Now, 2 days and two nights is too much, but my wild plan was to refuel the aircraft and to return to Talkeetna. So I was in the process of refueling the aircraft. I had a barrel pump. I was pumping 80 octane fuel from the barrel into my 5 gallon bucket, which was perched The 5 gallon bucket I might add was a chamois bucket with a chamois on top and a 500 mesh screen to stop any chamois lint or water that would get through the chamois. This is a precaution against contamination of your fuel. The chamois bucket was set on the wing. I was standing on the barrel pumping directly into the chamois bucket, which drained, of course, directly into the wing tank. Now, this was the last thing I remembered. The next thing I knew, I felt tremendous pain on the back of my head. I was soaked in gas, and I thought for one moment I'd gone to sleep and crashed. However, I was lying underneath the airplane and the light rain was falling, and I deducted that I'd gone to sleep pumping the plane full of gas and fell from the barrel onto the ground complete with the 5 gallon bucket of gas, which poured over me from head to foot. And my head ached. I'm lying in a big pile of rugged boulders there, cobblestones near the edge of the May Creek airfield. And I finally said, well, wait, after 2 days and two nights, I need some sleep. So I dug out my sleeping bag, put it under the wing, and the next thing I knew, I looked at my watch. It is now 6 o'clock p.m. The following afternoon. Tremendous swarms of mosquitoes are swarming around me. The sleeping bag is a woods eiderdown sleeping bag. The temperature is 95 in the shade. The procedure is to come up for a breath of air in my that is to come up out of the sleeping bag for breath of air. This we do while we sleep. And then after gaining the breath of air, the mosquitoes drive you back to the bottom of the 90 by 90 wood sleeping bag in the 95 degree temperature. As I say, the sun is shining brightly now. The overcast is cleared, and millions of very bloodthirsty, eager mosquitoes are awaiting my next breath of air as I poke my head out of the sleeping bag to escape some of the heat of the sleeping bag. When I realized the problem, I bailed out of the sleeping bag, which was soaking wet from the inside and the outside, threw it in the plane, finished gassing up the plane, and departed for Talkeetna. About 5 weeks later, I returned to the Anderson Glacier area and recovered the team, the UCLA team, including a very outstanding climber, Barbara Lilly. She's a Hughes secretary from California. She weighs about 90 pounds on the hoof. She's a very bright blonde. She is also an excellent mountaineer. At a later date, she made a very successful Mount McKinley climb. And I must say, she's one of the outstanding mountaineers that I have met in my travels. She's very small, as dainty as a flower. She insists she carries her own pack. She packs her own weight on the crew, and she's very sociable and very intelligent, and she's a great gal for the great outdoors of Alaska. At any rate, we, without further incident, recovered the 13-climber expedition from the Anderson Glacier, and they have credit for at least 14 first climbs in the Mount Logan area of the beautiful Wrangell Mountain Range. For a change of pace, let me explain an event that changed the direction of my Talkeetna flying endeavors in 1948. During this time, I had set up a air taxi operation in Talkeetna. I had two small aircraft, a two-passenger and a four-passenger aircraft. And I had hauled many tons of freight to the miners in the Cache Creek area, this very scenic Cache Creek area where they mine placer gold 50 miles west of Talkeetna. There's another area about 65 miles to the northwest of Talkeetna called the Fairview. It's been a continual gold producer for years. Cache Creek, however, is the older area. Even the Russians mine gold over there. More than 100 years ago. And on one particular day in July of 1948, I was returning two fishermen to Anchorage. Now, these two fishermen had spent 3 days in one of the prime rainbow fishing locations of this area, and with them they had two standard gas cases loaded with ice and big rainbow trout that would barely fit in the gas cases. They were quite proud of the catch, and as I offloaded the fishermen, their gear, and the two gas boxes full of beautiful rainbow trout, all neatly packed and iced, at Old Merrill Field, I was approached by an individual who introduced himself as Morrison, Robert Morrison. And he said, "I want to ask you one question. Where did you get those tremendous rainbows?" I said, "Are you a fisherman?" "Oh, yes." He says, "I'm a commercial fisherman from Honolulu. I sold my fishing fleet, and I'm up in Alaska on several projects. One of them is to go rainbow fishing." He says, "So where did you get the rainbows of that size? I've never seen any big 5-6 pound rainbows in my life." He said, "I didn't know that they got that big." And I told him, I said, "Well, Mr. Morrison, I won't tell you where I got them, but if you get your fishing pole, I will show you." So, in about 20 minutes, Robert Morrison appeared with a complete line of fishing gear, boots, and two big boxes of lures, and we were off to the fishing grounds. Now it developed that Mr. Morrison was more than a Honolulu fisherman, much more. He owned a considerable amount of property in Los Angeles, and a considerable amount of property in Los Angeles area, in addition to houses and various real estate in the Honolulu island area. His wife was Lena Morrison, and she had for years been a professional dancer to Royal Hawaiian Hotel, one of the great talented Samoan Hawaiian gals that perform in the Royal Hawaiian Hotel on all great occasions. Her specialties were Samoan dances, and she was a master at the old Hawaiian style of dancing, and furthermore, she was a tremendous teacher. Later on, and slightly ahead of this story, Morrison was so taken with the Talkeetna area, the wilderness area of Talkeetna, the tremendous fishing possibilities for salmon and rainbow and all other game fish, and he was also an outdoorsman. Within an hour's flight from Talkeetna, you can see all the major varieties of big game, the bears, the various varieties, the grizzly, the brown bears, especially in the season of July, August, when they're in evidence on the blueberry slopes and down eating salmon. Multitudes and millions of tons of salmon in seven or more great spawns head for this sources of the headwaters of the streams in this area, and there they spawn, and there also will you find the great bear population in the spawning grounds eating salmon. So Morrison, as I say, was greatly taken with a tremendous amount of game. The other big game would be the moose, the caribou, the mountain sheep, the mountain goats, and all the fine other fur, the caribou. Very available and practically not exploited. That is, the big game of the area was in plentiful abundance. So, after his fishing trip, which lasted from the afternoon of one day till about noon the next, he said, I want you to meet my wife here. I think that I will move to Talkeetna. And I said, well, all right, I'll go meet your wife. And it developed that a friend of Stubb Morrison, Rick, of Bob Morrison's, had borrowed a sum of $10,000. The friend was a gambler. The friend had started a small business called the Bendix Laundry of Anchorage, and also on the side he ran a very lucrative 4-5-6 game and a few card games. Well, it was a fact that this is against federal regulations, and the acquaintance that borrowed the $10,000 was on his way to about a two-year federal jail sentence. So he wanted to return the $10,000, which he didn't have, to Morrison, but he gave him the laundry instead. Now, the last thing Morrison wanted to do was to be involved in a laundry. However, he's very versatile. Also, the last thing the wife, the professional Hawaiian dancer, wanted to do was to be in charge of a laundry. So, as I say, Morrison was very versatile. He looked for a buyer and very shortly found one. He moved lock, stock, and barrel to Talkeetna. A typical conversation between myself and Morrison would be, Morrison now speaking, tell me, he would say, what type of a plane flies the best on floats, because there's many lakes in the area and the float plane you have is quite small. What is the best plane to haul 3 or 4 passengers on floats? I would name the various models and he'd say, well, let's buy one. Now, this wasn't as simple as it sounds. When he said buy an airplane, what he meant was put a down payment on one, and I was to pay the aircraft off on contract flying to the mines, to the mountains, charter cross-country up to the North Slope or wherever the revenue dictated. So, very shortly thereafter, 1 year later from the time Morrison arrived in Talkeetna, we had 8 aircraft all shined and ready to go on various configurations of floats, retractable skis, big tires for sandbar short landings. And we were extremely versatile. Also, we began to pick up some road building contracts. Having the proper equipment, we were able to haul considerable tonnage of freight to the new roads being built in this part of Alaska, primarily the Paxson's McKinley Park Cantwell Wonder Lake Road, a distance of several hundred miles. In August of 49, I acquired a contract with the old Alaska Road Commission in charge of this particular 200-mile stretch of road. And in addition to the other activities, hauled about 95% of the freight. The personnel, the surveyors, the geologists, the various cat skinners and personnel, and the supplies and the repair parts for this 200-mile stretch of a road. This is but one of many projects that helped pay for the lineup of valuable aircraft that Morrison would determine that we needed, and he would put the down payment on the aircraft, and I would endeavor to pay off the value of the aircraft before we demolished the aircraft. Now, actually, flying in tough conditions off airways, yeah, landing in places that no one ever had landed before, it is quite abrasive on aircraft. You must hopefully use good discretion, and if it's a sandbar, you must carefully check your wind, your obstructions, length of sandbar, condition of the sandbar, as for firmness. And there are many considerations in sandbar flying. There are many considerations in landing on glaciers, especially at altitude. You must never land where it would be impractical to take off again. Of course, the temperature plays a great role in whether you take off or you don't on a restricted area of takeoff. Many aircraft in Alaska have made a one-way trip on the takeoff, and the aircraft wound up in a big pile of junk because it was possibly overloaded, or it was downwind, or the temperature of the particular day was 30 degrees warmer than of the previous day when a successful takeoff may have been negotiated for the same strip. These are considerations of discretion, which are very vital to a successful operation of an air taxi operation involving aircraft and landing in these off airways, unprepared sandbars, and a great sand trap or high altitude lakes for float plane operation. I nearly missed that one, and it's very important. It involves all the factors mentioned plus a few more. A float plane, there are several models which are less affected by floats than other models. One of the great float planes ever designed was a Super Cub on floats, and then for the 4, 5, 6 passenger aircraft, the one that could carry 850 pounds, possibly the 180 Cessna, the G model. It's one of the great vintage designs. It's never been improved upon for float aircraft. Normally, floats would take at least 25% of the performance off the most planes to start with. However, with the 2870 floats with the stock model 6 passenger 180 Cessna. Considering limited fuel balanced against the payload of the passengers and freight, this 180 Cessna is the great performer in the float plane field. But the lessons are learned suddenly and sometimes with disastrous results. On one occasion in the Iron Mountains, I made a takeoff with about a 50% loaded aircraft, was unable to negotiate a turn, was unable to fly straight ahead, so the plane did the classic spin. The turn was to the left, the spin was to the left. And I went into the lake head first with disastrous results to the aircraft. Fortunately, I was able to swim ashore with the passenger. This is one of the very expensive on-the-job training lessons of flying aircraft in various configurations of weight, temperature, altitude, and load configurations. Tremendous amount of aircraft have been left scattered over Alaska, also for weather considerations. In spite of the fact the aircraft may have been properly loaded and flown by a very suitable pilot, the joker is sometimes weather. Weather can exceed the capability of the airplane by forming ice on the outside of the airplane. There can be obscurement. You could possibly be on a perfect inbound course to a navigational facility and at the wrong altitude and trim the top of a mountain. This has been the case. This is a normal procedure. This has happened hundreds of times, not only in Alaska, but in bad weather conditions in other locations. The whole word on flying the bush in Alaska is discretion. And there are many sand traps to evade. Pilot air, of course, accommodates about 95% of the aircraft disasters in Alaska. The other 5% is probably mechanical type failure, but even a properly handled, a mechanical failure can be resolved with no damage to the aircraft. In some cases, I want to tell you a story of